invisible.
Bueno, esto es.
Well, this is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. El pueblo saharaui lleva décadas luchando por su liberación nacional.
The Sahrawi people have been fighting for their national liberation for decades, seeking to reclaim their entire territory, which is currently being illegally occupied by Morocco, particularly the most resource-rich areas. Morocco has strong ties with Western powers, including the Zionist entity that occupies Palestine today. Nevertheless, the Sahrawi people and their political leadership through the Polisario Front refuse to accept this situation. They continuously fight on multiple fronts, diplomatic, economic, and political. And their military struggle is also a significant aspect of their resistance. Despite suffering losses, they remain resilient against the Moroccan occupiers, who also face ongoing casualties. To discuss the current situation of the Sahrawi people, the government of the Sahrawi Democratic Republic and the Polisario Front, we have a special guest from Spain. Abdullah Araby is with us. He is a prominent Sahrawi political leader and has represented the Polisario Front in Spain since 2020. Abdullah plays a crucial role in advocating for his people's rights and the liberation of Western Sahara. Welcome, Abdullah Araby, to our program, Black and White.
Bienvenido, Abdullah Araby, a nuestro programa Negro y Blanco.
Muchas gracias y un placer estar.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be part of this program and share the perspective of the Sahrawi people regarding the current situation surrounding the Western Sahara conflict. I hope to clarify some recent developments that hold significant political importance from various viewpoints. This situation also adds a layer of risk to the current international landscape where international law is under threat. As the Sahrawi people, we have been resisting for 48 years to ensure that nothing contrary to international law is imposed upon us, which embodies our struggle and resilience. Thank you for providing us with this platform.
Muchas gracias por ofrecernos este espacio.
Abdullah, justamente lo que acabas de decir tú, el derecho internacional.
Abdullah, you just echoed what I have been thinking. It's all about international law. Honestly, when you take a closer look, there are numerous agreements that have been ignored, UN resolutions that haven't been acted upon, and potential referendums that never took place. Ultimately, the Sahrawi people, their government, and the Polisario Front find themselves in a situation where international law is not being upheld. Disregard comes from imperialism, Zionism, and quite evidently, the Moroccan regime as well. So where does the Sahrawi people's struggle stand today?
De la lucha al pueblo saharaui.
Pues yo creo que es muy importante aclarar.
I believe it's crucial to clarify and highlight certain aspects to truly understand the essence of the Sahrawi people's struggle and the complexities they face due to the geopolitical relationships, especially when economic interests overshadow international law. The issue of Western Sahara is fundamentally one of unfinished decolonization, where Spain, as the administering power, left the territory open to illegal military occupation by Morocco, which continues to this day. Since then, the Sahrawi people, represented by the Polisario Front, recognized by the United Nations as a liberation movement, have been fighting to reclaim the occupied part of Western Sahara. They declared their state, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which currently has recognition from 84 countries, primarily in Latin America and Africa. We are a founding member of the African Union, holding full membership and sitting alongside Morocco as two free and sovereign nations within the organization. This context is essential to understanding the political and legal nature of Western Sahara. Over the past 48 years, Morocco has sought to establish a policy of fait accompli, taking advantage of the natural resources found in Western Sahara, particularly phosphates and fishing. It uses these resources to negotiate with European Union countries, attempting to influence trade agreements based on the political stances it has managed to shift in recent years, especially those of Spain and France. The clear aim is to pressure these nations to abandon their support for international law, and align with Morocco's expansionist ambitions. This sets the stage for the political and legal context surrounding the Western Sahara issue. However, as a people, we are acutely aware of the risks inherent in our current situation. We will continue to hold steadfast in our struggle and resistance to ensure that the resolutions of the United Nations are respected and that the Sahrawi people's right to self-determination and independence is upheld.
Abdullah, we are going to take a short break and we will be right back. We're back with Abdullah Araby here on Black and White. Abdullah, since 2017, the Moroccan regime has proposed an initiative that it's important to understand the stance of both the Sahrawi Democratic Government and the Polisario Front. I'm referring to what they call the autonomy or the autonomous region of the Sahara. What are your thoughts? How do you see it?
¿Qué opinan? ¿Cómo lo ven ustedes?
Bueno, partiendo de que la naturaleza política y jurídica del Sahara Occidental es de descolonización.
The political and legal status of Western Sahara is fundamentally about decolonization, which means that from this viewpoint, Morocco's proposed autonomy cannot be seen as a viable solution. As the Polisario Front, we advocate for the Sahrawi people's right to self-determination, which inherently includes the possibility of independence. If the international community or Morocco suggests autonomy as a resolution, they should allow the Sahrawi people to choose between these two options. Without a doubt, the Sahrawi people would opt for independence, which is precisely why Morocco is reluctant to engage in a self-determination referendum. Therefore, this is a proposal that ultimately does not exist. The personal envoy of the United Nations Secretary General recently asked Morocco in October to develop this proposal or supposed proposal, as there are only 3 pages available at the United Nations. Countries that have supported it, like Spain and France, are also in a difficult position because it is impossible to advocate for an option that does not exist at the UN level. Morocco's sole aim with this is to try to impose its illegal occupation of Western Sahara, prolonging the suffering of the Sahrawi people under the assumption that over time they would cease to fight and resist. However, nearly 50 years of struggle demonstrate that the Sahrawi people are fully determined to seek a peaceful resolution, while also maintaining their commitment to continue their fight and resistance until they achieve their ultimate goals of freedom and independence.
Abdullah, how can a referendum be conducted under favorable or objective conditions for the Sahrawi people, considering the historical context of the famous Green March and the colonization of Sahrawi territory by Moroccan settlers? This raises a significant issue because, in such a vote, would the settlers participate or would it be limited to those who are truly entitled to vote? In my view, I'm aligning myself with the original inhabitants, namely the Sahrawi people.
No,
that's not correct. This is part of the propaganda used by Morocco to suggest that the referendum is unfeasible. Since 1991, there has been a United Nations mission in the territory known as MINURSO, which is dedicated to organizing a referendum in Western Sahara. This clearly indicates that the resolution for Western Sahara should involve a referendum where the Sahrawi people can vote freely. However, Morocco argues that the presence of settlers in the occupied part of Western Sahara complicates the distinction between these settlers and the current Sahrawi population. Nevertheless, the United Nations has an official census conducted by the Identification Commission, which lists 84,000 individuals who are eligible to vote in the referendum when it takes place. What Morocco is trying to distort is the idea that a referendum is not feasible. We believe that if autonomy is seen as a solution, then the United Nations' proposal for a self-determination referendum must be honored. The Sahrawi people should have the right to choose between these options or any other solution that may arise. As a Sahrawi people, we can no longer compromise. We have only given up on solely pursuing our complete independence by accepting a referendum that includes other options, such as integration with Morocco. However, I believe Morocco has been forced to acknowledge that the solution will indeed involve a referendum, which they are unlikely to win. They are attempting to mislead the world, especially influential countries, into thinking that autonomy is the only solution they can offer.
Absolutely. They fear the referendum and the voice of the Sahrawi people, without a doubt. Abdullah, the struggle for decolonization is unique, yet it also has an international dimension. In this context, how are the relationships with decolonization movements, particularly with the Palestinian people who are heroically fighting against the Zionist settlers occupying nearly all Palestinian lands and currently facing brutal oppression?
We always express our utmost solidarity and support for the Palestinian people in their resistance and struggle against occupation, aggression, and daily human rights violations, which can only be described as genocide. What we are witnessing in the world today is alarming, and when I say that international law is at risk, I mean that we cannot accept or tolerate the normalization of genocide affecting the Palestinian people. This situation is not normal, and people around the globe must mobilize to defend international law and fight against injustices. What Israel is doing to the Palestinian people mirrors what Morocco is doing to the Sahrawi people. It's important to remember that Israel is currently supporting Morocco in its new conflict against the Sahrawi people, both militarily and economically, and is providing constant advice to Morocco. Therefore, our struggle is not only against Morocco, but also against Israel's presence alongside Morocco. We fully understand that the fight of the peoples is the only way to uphold international law and ensure that injustices are not forgotten, as some would like us to believe. Palestine and the Sahrawi people will show that there is still hope to combat injustices, enforce international law, and ensure that human rights are respected worldwide.
Absolutely. Even now, there have been significant pro-Palestinian demonstrations in Morocco aimed at preventing military shipments linked to Israel and its Zionist entity. What you've mentioned is crucial because it highlights a struggle against Zionism, colonialism, and imperialism, advocating for the genuine self-determination of peoples. Now, let's focus on specific questions as we near the end. How are the Sahrawi people living today in Western Sahara?
El pueblo saharaui en la parte Sahara occidental.
Morocco is currently becoming a key player in facilitating aggression against the Palestinian people. All the ships transporting arms to Israel, which are primarily turned away here in Spain, pass through Moroccan ports before delivering that material to Israel for its indiscriminate use against the Palestinian civilian population. The Sahrawi people will continue their struggle despite facing challenging times, but it's important to remember that on October 4th, the European Court of Justice ruled that the economic agreements between Morocco and the European Union, which included the natural resources of the Western Sahara, were illegal and thus rejected. This victory for the Sahrawi people against the European Commission, the Council of the European Union, Morocco, and European countries like France and Spain, who also participated in this unlawful battle, serves as a beacon of hope and illustrates that the fight and resilience of any people ultimately leads to triumph. We've obtained the rulings that now allow us to pursue and protect the natural resources of Western Sahara from any country or company. This clearly illustrates my earlier point. The political and legal status of Western Sahara remains unchanged. Not even Trump's tweet or Pedro Sanchez's position as prime minister or Macron's stance can change it. Thus, the legal strength of Western Sahara is a result of the ongoing struggle and resilience of the Sahrawi people, who are equally determined to continue their fight and resistance.
para conseguir resistiendo y luchando.
Thank you, Abdullah. We have reached the end. We truly appreciate your presence and send you our best wishes for success in the struggle for self-determination and national liberation of the Sahrawi people.
Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you very much.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio today is their friend Sheikh Muhammad Khani from the Islamic Seminary of Qom and Dr. Ali Alawiyan. I welcome you both to this program and I hope that we will have a fruitful discussion today. Bi-idhnillahi ta'ala.
Thank you very much.
Our topic today, dear friends, is about drugs, more specifically drug addiction. So I want to start out by asking the dear Sheikh Muhammad Khani about this problem of drug addiction. Do they need help or should we punish them?
See, it's a quite a deep question and sometimes it's very difficult to give a general answer, a general ruling to such a complicated or complex question, but just to make it clear, prevention is always better than cure. So first and foremost, if you want to talk about how to deal with drug addicts, addiction, we need to talk about how to prevent people from becoming drug addicts first and foremost. Talk about how we can prevent people from becoming drug addicts or become addicted to drugs. Because we have to look at the different reasons why people, they fall into drug addiction before talking about how to deal with them afterwards.
Right.
Or else we're just going to talk about how to solve some of the symptoms of the main issue or the root of the issue, which is why people, they actually become drug addicts in the first place.
Right.
So we need to solve that issue. And then afterwards, we can talk about whether they actually need help or they need to be punished. Because we have to define what is punishment in this situation. Are we talking about imprisonment? Or are we talking about help in just acknowledging that they are drug addicts? We have to define the two words. In other words, we have to define help and punishment before we can talk about these two concepts being useful or not. So,
right. Then, Sheikh, let me ask you this question then. In Islam, how is drug addiction or just drugs generally viewed upon?
Of course, we know that the general ruling when it comes to drugs or any intoxicating drugs, it could be like alcohol, it could be anything else, they have the same ruling. It's haram, it's impermissible to consume it, therefore we're not allowed to consume it. So that's the general ruling. But if a person, he has an addiction, it's not always enough just to tell him that it's haram. Like, we need to help them before actually talking about punishment in form of imprisonment. Because normally when we talk about punishments, we normally talk about imprisonment.
Right.
We're talking about sending them to prison and so on and so forth. And that doesn't really solve the issue because of the studies that we actually have shows that people, they are consuming drugs even in prisons, right?
Right.
So you're taking a person who is addicted to something, putting him with people that have exactly the same issue as this guy. So you're not solving the issue from the root. Therefore, you're actually making it worse sometimes in certain situations or certain cases, right?
Right, yeah.
So
help, in Islam, yes, if I might interrupt you, what is the punishment for using drugs or selling drugs, perhaps? Is it also imprisonment?
Yeah, we have to separate the two. It's two different discussions. Selling drugs is something. Consuming drugs is something else. If a person is addicted to it, he's hurting himself and his family and his close people, the people that are close to him. So this person, we need to help him if he actually wants to get rid of that addiction. But it needs to come from himself, right?
Right.
Because habits and addictions, you can't solve it by controlling other individuals. It needs to come from themselves.
Would you say then, dear Sheikh, that punishment is not an effective remedy or cure for a drug addiction?
I would say punishment is necessary when it comes to people selling drugs.
Only when selling drugs.
Important and exporting drugs and ruining people's lives. In other words, making money on selling drugs. So I would say that you need, that's punishment. Like, you need punishment for dealing with that. Yeah.
What about you, Dr. Alawiyan? When is punishment suitable? only when selling drugs and also when you are addicted to drugs.
In the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. The respected Sheikh gave a pretty good answer to the question that an addict is looked at as a sick person, so he has to be looked at with care and attention to see what kind of attention is needed to be given to him or her. But to actually issue a general verdict to see is punishment better or, let's say, encouragement or even taking care of them better, I think it differs case by case. As we have seen previously in our country here, we were imprisoning the people who were addicts. Now, I mean, the strategy changed, and now they are not being sent to the jails anymore, but they are looked after in some centers to leave this habit.
Right.
But for those, as Sheikh said properly, for those who are actually providing the drugs for the people, they need to be punished because they knowingly actually are providing some poisons for the lives of the people. Not only a person who is addicted to the drug is the only victim, but also the family and the whole society around him are the ones who are actually affected by the drug itself. So those who knowingly are actually selling or providing or importing and exporting these things need to be punished.
How should they be punished, if I might interrupt you?
Look, punishment also, again, differs on the level of the knowledge of the person who had, which is actually is the duty of a judge to distinguish which one is needed to have. For example, a person who transfers, for example, 1,000 kilo of, for example...
Cocaine.
Knowingly, so as the rulings and, let's say, laws here in this country says he has to be actually punished for the... to be...
Executed.
It's life sentence now.
Yeah.
I think they removed the execution.
No execution now. Only imprisonment?
I think
1,000, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I think they actually removed capital punishment for people importing drugs, if I'm not mistaken.
As far as I know, it was for 1,000 kilo, or 1 ton, it was execution.
Oh, okay. So.
But it has changed, for example, for lower amounts.
Okay. Yeah.
For a lighter
amount. Also for drivers as well. That's what I think. Like,
yeah.
People that are importing. But doing it because of,
necessity.
Poverty and they're poor, you know, they need to make money. They're forced into these things. Normally they're excused, but people that, no, they make a lot of money and they're the people that we consider to be...
Like Pablo Escobar in the West.
Exactly, right? The people that are behind the very scenes, true. Right? They're working behind the scenes. They normally get the capital punishment, if I'm not mistaken.
I need to check exactly for the... Because I think they have defined some, amounts for the, for example, 5 kilo, 10 kilos, or let's say when it goes to 1,000 kilo. So the punishment differs. But for those, that is, I mean, the core of our discussion, which is about those who are addicted and have got this bad habit of being addicts. So for them, I think punishment is not a good solution. And as it has been understood well and it is being practiced, I think it is the way that is being practiced these days, that they need to be cared, to be cured.
Dear Sheikh, do we have any treatments mentioned in Islam, how we can treat such a problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I know there's a association right now that are dealing with these issues and finding solutions that they can actually implement in the different rehab centers around Iran. But if we have to look at what is drug addiction is basically a habit. It's an addiction, right? So it's something that you're used to because of the pleasure that are behind it. So normally when they discuss this in ethics, when it comes to habits, how to deal with habits, especially if it's a bad habit, normally they say that you have to replace that habit, especially if it's accompanied by some sort of a pleasure.
Right.
Because a person is normally not ready to sacrifice the pleasure if not it's replaced with something, right?
True. Yeah.
So if a person understands or he felt or experienced the pleasure of being a healthy person, normally he's not willing to sacrifice this pleasure for a pleasure that is lower than that. For example, eating unhealthy, there's some pleasure related to that as well. Yeah. But if you're a healthy person and you experience what it means to be healthy, you're normally not willing to eat unhealthy and experience that pleasure because you're going to sacrifice another and greater pleasure because of that.
So we should introduce something that is, I don't want to say as addictive, but as pleasurable as drugs.
We should find a solution and give him the tools to actually strengthen his own willpower. That's first and foremost, yeah? Because they have to come from outside. You cannot control people's addictions. Right. You cannot be like, you shouldn't do it if he wants to do it. Sooner or later, if he's under control, if he's in a controlled environment, sooner or later he's going to do it. You can control it for a period, for example. That's why we say, like, when we have to raise our children, we do exactly the same thing. We give them the willpower enough or strengthen their willpower enough so they can take the right decisions when they grow older instead of taking decisions for them, right? Because right. when they grow older and we're not there to control them anymore, they're not going to take the right decisions in life. So when it comes to drug addicts, it's quite similar. We have to strengthen their willpower first and foremost. Then second, we have to discuss how we can replace that habit or give him the tools to replace that habit because the addict himself has to do it. We can't replace habits for him. But we need to show him how to do it and give him the tools to do it. And then afterwards, try to give him some alternatives. So one of the things they normally do, if I'm not mistaken, you probably know better than me about it. In these rehab centers, they have a tendency to replace the pleasure of, for example, working out or having a healthy, like being healthy as an individual and having a healthy diet next to working out, going to the gym. And that normally helps, not only from a psychological perspective, but also from a physical perspective, right? Because they get rid of the drugs and the habits or the need for having this drug physically.
So, may I add something to the explanations of the respected sheikh? When you're asking the respected sheikh, I want you to correct me if I'm mistaken.
Of course,
what is the Islamic viewpoint on this? When sheikh is answering, actually, he's inducing from Islamic principles, like that of, for example, لا تلقوا بيدكم لا تهلك. So this is a general ruling. And then sheikh dissects the exact case that you are talking about. So it doesn't mean that in Islam, specifically on the issue of addicts, has some rulings on this specific case. Though we have some
general rulings,
traditions and hadith, even from imams, that even names the banj, what is called bang in the hadith itself, the name of the banj is mentioned. So, but I want to clarify the issue for the listeners and for ourselves to say that Sheikh actually is inducing, the same way that you are asking him for a solution for or a remedy for the people who are afflicted with that actual affliction. So again, Sheikh is inducing from Islamic, different Islamic narrations and hadith and verdicts, and he comes and strengthening the willpower. So since it is, he knows that he understood the person earlier, he understood what the reason or the background of this illness is, that is a mental illness, something that has been affected due to some circumstances from the family side or from the friend side. So then Sheikh is giving you a prescription that is the strengthening the willpower or changing the environment of the person to go towards another, let's say, environment to let him forget whatever he was and to propose to him some new pleasures that is more motivating from the previous pleasures.
So and healthy as well. And healthy as well, right? It should be pleasurements that are healthy for himself, his environment, his families, because they exist as well, right?
Right. And with that, we will unfortunately have to end today's discussion because we are out of time. Dear Sheikh, I thank you.
Thank you for
insightful
us.
Knowledge. And I also thank the dear doctor for contributing to this discussion. And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness, everything which makes no sense. Know that you exist. You are the light. It guides me through my darkest nights. It shows me right from wrong and left. A world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth. Well, in this program, what we do is to talk about some of the viewpoints and sentences of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and talk about some of the points in these statements. Well, about the subject of people's participation in Iranian revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "Like Islam, the Islamic revolution enjoys various political, economic, social, cultural, spiritual, and other aspects. And it is in conformity with natural human needs. And this is the secret behind the stability of the Islamic revolution of Iran and its increasing spread in the region and the world." Well, this viewpoint of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is about his trust and rely on people and their help in forming Iranian revolution. One important characteristic of the path of the Imam is the role of general public both in elections and other social matters. You know, revolutions were prevalent in the first half of the 20th century, and various kinds of revolutions were started in the East and the West. But holding a referendum to determine the form of government only 2 months after the victory of the revolution has been unprecedented in the history of all revolutions. This happened in Iran due to the efforts made by the Imam Rahmatullah Alayh. Less than a year had passed since the victory of revolution when the constitution was formulated and ratified. Our elections were never cancelled, even during the most difficult days of the war when Tehran was being bombed by the enemy. Not even a single election has been postponed until this day. Which democracy has been like this? No democracies, let alone revolutions, have held elections as punctually and carefully as we have. This is the path of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. In various other issues that were not related to elections, the Imam Rahmatullah Alayh used to pay attention to the role of the people. He used to explicitly emphasize the role of people, even in the days prior to his demise and in the last day of his life in particular, when the top officials or individuals from various strata would pay him a visit at the hospital. The Holy Imam Rahmatullah Alayh prayed for the beloved people, and these prayers continued unceasingly. He would pray for the people's benefaction and good final destiny all the time. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we have for today's episode of Spring of the Truth. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh about Iranian people's participation in the revolution. Well, he said, like Islam, the Islamic revolution enjoys various political, economic, social, cultural, spiritual, and other aspects, and it is in conformity with natural human needs. And this is the secret behind the stability of the Islamic revolution of Iran and its increasing spread in the region and the world. Thank you very much, and until another episode, I bid you farewell, and may Allah protect you all.
Hello, welcome back to a new episode of The Cradle Bites. Today, William Van Wagenen is joining me, my fellow at The Cradle. He's a journalist, a writer, and he has an upcoming book regarding the Syrian war. Hello, William.
Hey, Kareem, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Fine.
I'm good.
So today, we're going to talk about the recent events that happened in Syria, especially in Aleppo. And, of course, there's many people hearing about the SDF, the SNA, and of course about Al-Nusra Front. So can you talk to us more about them and what happened in the past 3 days?
Yeah, so the Nusra Front, or their current name, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, they're a former Al-Qaeda group led by Abu Muhammad al-Jolani, who is a member of the Islamic State of Iraq and a colleague or a deputy of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So he's enjoyed support from the United States, from Qatar, from Turkey for many, many years. In fact, his group, the Nusra Front at the time, they were able to capture Idlib governorate in Syria, in northwest Syria, in 2015, largely with the help of suicide bombers on the one hand and the U.S. Supplied the TOW anti-tank missiles on the other. The CIA supplying those. So that's how Idlib became, quote-unquote, the largest al-Qaeda haven since 9/11, according to Brett McGurk, a former, actually current U.S. Counterterrorism official, although that phrase is kind of a misnomer because it's the United States that's supporting terrorism, obviously. So they invaded parts of Aleppo from Idlib on Wednesday. They were joined by another group called the Syrian National Army, which is Turkish-backed. Basically, they're Turkish mercenaries. That group includes many former ISIS members. The group incorporated many ISIS members when it formed, and they basically occupied territory northeast of Aleppo with the help of the Turkish army. So they joined in on the attack, and then finally there's the Syrian Democratic Forces. They're Kurdish. Basically, it's the PKK. Just think of them as the Kurdistan Workers' Party, who have occupied northeast Syria with U.S. forces for the past 8 years, basically stealing Syrian oil and sending it on through Kurdistan, Iraq, and then Turkey so that it can be purchased by Israel. So it was a shock, though, because, for example, Armenian journalist Kavor Kalmasian, who's a really great analyst, he was warning in October that these U.S. and Israeli backed groups, namely Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or HTS, they were preparing a big offensive, to attack Syria from the northwest. As Israel was bombing sites along the Syria-Lebanon border and in the Golan Heights as part of the war with Hezbollah, because Syria is a very important member of the Axis of Resistance, and all the weapons that come to Hezbollah come, maybe not all, but many of them come through Syria across the borders to the Baqa Valley. So anyways, Kavor Kalmasian, he was warning since October that this big offensive was coming. These so-called rebel groups were creating videos, and they had all this brand new equipment, and you could tell they were well-funded. They had a good media operation or propaganda operation going. Typically, it's British intelligence that would run media operations for these al-Qaeda groups. And Kavork basically predicted it, and he was warning on Twitter all over the place. And then suddenly on Wednesday, these groups came, and the Syrian army basically put up very little, if any, resistance, and HTS was able to take multiple villages, and then finally on Saturday, they were able to occupy large parts of western Aleppo, including the ancient citadel. So it's a big shock. The SNA, Syrian National Army, they joined as well. But then the Kurdish forces, they came and tried to help defend Aleppo, at least the Kurdish neighborhoods like Sheikh Mahsoud. And they've essentially been allied with the Syrian army. So the situation is very tough for civilians in Aleppo. There's like food shortages emerging. And the road to Damascus has been cut off, the M5 highway. So it's kind of a shock. Apparently, Syrian forces have been regrouped north of the city of Hama. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it is shocking because in the first 24 hours, the armed groups, they announced that they took over 34 villages and towns. And the next day, they announced that they acquired 52 towns and villages. And the third day, we saw them in the heart of Aleppo. It was so shocking. I think the Syrians and the Russians, they trusted Turkey too much. Because, of course, that was a breach of the agreement that happened four years ago between the three parties, between Syria, Iran, and Russia on one hand, and Turkey on the other hand, that these borders will not be breached or no attacks will occur from Idlib into Aleppo. But that's exactly what happened 3 days ago. And as you said, currently the Syrian army is stationed northern of Hama, and there's fierce battles currently. And before we started this bites, I read that the Syrian army regained around 12 villages and towns, and the clashes are still ongoing. And of course, Russia also is aiding the Syrian army in their airstrikes against these armed groups in Idlib and in the outskirts of Aleppo. And of course, we saw that the Syrian army used the Toshka missile, which is a tactical ballistic missile against these groups. Until now, still days will tell us what will happen, because before we were chatting, me and William, and you remember that it took them more than 1 year, or maybe 2 years, to regain the M5 fraud that you talked about. And it's very weird that they let it out, and they didn't even defend it, and that the groups took it in 2 days. Yeah, the road is very important. It connects Syria, West Syria to East Syria, to North Syria. It's a very important road. And thus, there were no resistance. Do you have any thoughts about that? There's people saying that the Syrian army fled away. People said that people were bribed. Maybe what happened is similar to what happened in Mosul. So do you have an idea about these stories?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I have no inside information or anything, but those are all possibilities. I mean, on the one hand, if you want to be more optimistic, you could say, you know, maybe there's a strategy on the part of the army that they, didn't have the forces to repel the attack. I mean, apparently there's a huge attack, large numbers of these HCS militants with tanks and large numbers of drones. Apparently they received many, many drones from Ukraine. And as we've seen, you know, with Hezbollah attacking northern Israel for the past year, drones are just playing a huge role in warfare now. And it's kind of hard to surprise anyone with big troop movements. So again, that's another reason it seems odd that the Syrian army appeared to be unprepared. I mean, there's Russian surveillance. They would have seen all of these troops massing. But, you know, maybe there is an advantage that the militants had as a result of drones. And they had tanks, et cetera. So, you know, hopefully there is, again, I'm not a military person, so I probably shouldn't even comment, but hopefully there is a strategy behind it. And maybe the militants are getting overstretched by occupying too much territory. And then, you know, the Syrian army and the Russians will basically take them out, largely through airstrikes, perhaps, and quickly regain the territory. But it's just disturbing because, you know, basically, the so-called rebels in 2012, basically a Salafist FSA group called the Liwa al-Ta'hid, and then also the Al-Qaeda group Jabhat al-Nusra, which is now HTS. They invaded Aleppo and terrorized the inhabitants of the east side of the city there, totally looted everything, looted the factories, kidnapped many, many people, lots of Christians especially. And it took the Syrian army until December 2016 to liberate the city. And it was, you know, there were a lot of sacrifices that had to be made to liberate Aleppo back then. So to see it just fall so quickly, again, you know, it just is kind of reminiscent of Mosul in 2014, where Masoud Barzani and the U.S. And the Saudis and the Turks had basically done a deal with ISIS to allow ISIS to come in and take over Mosul, where Masoud Barzani's Peshmerga would then take over Kirkuk and take over the oil fields there so they could start exporting oil via Turkey to Israel. And so there was a lot of collaboration between Erdogan and Israel all through that period, even though Erdogan even then was, you know, speaking strongly against the Israelis constantly. So that's an interesting aspect now, is that Erdogan for the past year since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza has been one of the strongest people to publicly or verbally condemn Israel. But of course, he's still been allowing oil to travel through Turkey from Azerbaijan that's fueled the Israeli war machine. And now it looks exactly like Erdogan and Netanyahu were collaborating just like in the old days, because as soon as there was a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, Netanyahu gave a speech where he threatened Syria. And they immediately started bombing the borders between Lebanon and Syria. And then journalist Vanessa Bealey, who's based in Damascus, was immediately warning when the ceasefire was signed. She said, now they're going to turn to Syria. And That's exactly what happened, where these HTS militants that enjoy and SNA militants that enjoy Turkish support and Israeli and U.S. support, of course, they immediately invaded Aleppo. So there's definitely coordination with the Israelis going on. That seems quite obvious.
Yeah, of course. And of course, we saw their social media during the war. Every time Israel hits any base or any positions for Hezbollah, these people in Idlib, they were cheering for Israel and like even asking Israel to go harder and harder. And now suddenly after the war ends, and we know Hezbollah is not as powerful as before. Now I think they withdrew many people from Syria. So they took a chance and they attacked. And of course we all heard Netanyahu threatening Bashar al-Assad in person, and he named him this time. And many people now, especially the Iraqis, are very afraid that this will spread to other places, not only in Idlib and Aleppo. They're afraid that maybe something would occur on their borders. And we saw many Iraqis going to the border, many armed Iraqis from the government. And others, people saying that they are going to aid the Syria and the Syrian army. I don't think so, personally. I think these are like people only going to defend the Iraqi borders, because currently I don't think they are able to do that, especially with the threats from Israel. I think if there's like a big group going to Syria or coming towards the Lebanese border, they will be bombed, unfortunately. So what do you think? Do you think this might spread to other places, or it would remain in Idlib? Would it be happening in other places?
It's hard to say, because in recent, about in the past year, there has been closer collaboration between the Iraqi government in Baghdad and the Turkish government. Turkey has invaded northern Iraq, the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq, with the collaboration of, again, Masoud Barzani's KDP in Erbil, but also with the apparent agreement of the government in Baghdad. They're trying to build this new transit route from Basra in the south of Iraq, this like a commercial or economic highway that travels all the way up northern Iraq and into Turkey. And so I don't know if the Iraqi government would stand in the way of Turkey potentially coming deeper into Iraq from the north. And I can tell you that Yazidis that I've spoken with in Sinjar, which is west of Mosul and basically right in the firing line if the Turks invade further, they are really terrified right now of another genocide, because, again, after Turkey and the Kurds and the U.S. Schemes to take over Mosul, let ISIS take over Mosul in 2014, that was in June, and just 2 months later, then Masoud Barzani facilitated ISIS fighters to move into Sinjar, which had been occupied by the Kurdish Peshmerga until that time. The Kurdish Peshmerga withdrew on purpose, deliberately, so that ISIS could come in and massacre Yazidis and take them as sex slaves and commit the genocide. And so Yazidis now in Sinjar are really scared that something similar could happen. And even earlier this year, there were a lot of reports of ISIS members being released from the prisons in Hasaka under PKK or the SDF control. A lot of people don't know there's a lot of collaboration between the PKK and ISIS, and many former ISIS members were incorporated in the PKK. And there's basically been this army in waiting of ISIS members sitting in the Elbhol camp under the PKK or the SDF control. And a lot of them were released from prison earlier this summer. So Yazidis have been really worried ever since the summer that something's going to happen. And then seeing these hordes of Turkish and U.S. and Israeli-backed mercenaries invading Aleppo is definitely making them fearful right now of another genocide. So,
yeah, we have hard times upon us. And, of course, I think Russia and Iran should up their game. Because currently we all know that Gaza is now turned into a rubble. Apparently Hezbollah didn't do very well in the recent war, and now they are weaker than before. And now if the turn is to Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian government, then Iran will be left, and then they will attack Iran directly. That's my thoughts, because if you look at it from an Israeli perspective, okay, Hamas now is very weak. Okay, we made a deal with Hezbollah, which is now weak. We have the Syrian army. Now they are fighting in the north. We can maybe invade from the south, maybe take more land near Jolan, south of Damascus. And then we will like have all the time left for Iran. Maybe try to make like sabotage or like different attacks as they always do inside Iran. So I think, and of course Russia, if Syria is weaker, Hezbollah is weaker, and if Iran is weaker, then Russia is weaker because, let's be honest, Russia doesn't have like a lot of allies. They have some allies in Africa, and of course China. But other than that, and in Europe, and in North America, and in South America, their allies, they are not like that sovereign, or they are not as effective as, of course, Iran and the acts of resistance in the region.
Yeah, and you know, I worry about Russia. I mean, they have interests in Syria, so you would think that they would intervene strongly to prevent what's going on, but which they did to their credit in 2015. I will always give President Putin a major credit for stepping in 2015 in September with the Russian Air Force. And yeah, again, you know, these reports of the army regrouping north of Hama and retaking villages. And again, I'm not a military person at all. So hopefully I'm, you know, just kind of ignorant to the situation. And there is a good counteroffensive plan in place. And the Russians will come in hard and help the Syrian army. I will continue to. Again, I don't want to be too negative and downplay what they're doing. But I guess, you know, we'll kind of see in the coming days.
Do you have any final words, William?
No, I mean, I guess I would just say maybe a final word on Hezbollah and the ceasefire. I mean, one thing is that when Israel massacred, you know, probably hundreds of its own soldiers and civilians on 7th of October with helicopters and drones and tanks to the Hannibal Directive, and use that as a pretext to go into Gaza, they were also trying to launch a preemptive strike against Hezbollah at that time. I don't know if these reports are true, but supposedly the Biden administration essentially asked them to hold off and wait and just focus on the genocide in Gaza. But I think it is really commendable what Hezbollah was able to do, because in my opinion, Israel's goal wasn't just to return the settlers to the north, or get 1701 implemented, or have the Lebanese army, you know, deployed to the border. Their goal was to totally remake the Middle East and destroy Hezbollah. And Israel, again, with the backing of the United States, is just a powerful and sinister enemy. And Hezbollah was able to stand up to them and survive and inflict casualties. There's still a lot of danger, again, with Trump coming into office. You know, maybe the supplies of weapons may accelerate even more than they did under Biden, which would be shocking, but could be possible. So probably hard days ahead, but I just feel like that was a big achievement on the part of Hezbollah. And I mentioned this to you before, but yesterday I had the chance to go to the place where Hassan Nasrallah was martyred, and there were a lot of people there, and everyone was very sad, and a lot of people were praying, but the few people I was able to talk to basically said, you know, we lost Hassan Nasrallah and that was a big blow, but we did stand up to Israel and we fought hard and we're still here. We still have our weapons. We still have our men. So I think that's a major achievement to keep in mind.
Okay. Thank you, William. Thank you.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
جنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه